Adults over 50 are the fastest growing population worldwide. Substance use disorder among older adults has been increasing at an alarming rate. I'm Dr. Brent Schillinger, along with my colleague, Dr. Abby Strauss. And joining us, taking a deep dive into this topic today, is Dr. Devin Dautrick, PhD. Dr. Dautrick is Supervisor of Psychological Testing Services and Older Adult Program at the Karen Treatment Center in Wienersville. She treats older adults with substance use disorder with a focus on diagnostic assessment, cognitive testing, and evidence-based care. Dr. Dautrick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First question, how do you define older?
Good question. Typically speaking, we're looking at the baby boomer generation. The research will say there's older adults and then there's old adults, which kind of separates the older generation into two age groups. So usually 60 to 75 and then 75 plus. That's what we are typically treating as folks over the age of 60 with substance use disorders.
This alarming increase in the SUD amongst older adults. Is this truly a trend, or is it just because we're looking for it? Is it something that's been overlooked and underdiagnosed, or is it really a direction that things are moving in?
It's definitely a trend. And I think the other piece of that question is also true. I think we had been overlooking it for a while and to some degree continue to overlook it. We're missing a lot of people out there that have substance use disorders.
One of the things that strikes me also about this age group, this is a group that has grown up where mental health is not necessarily the shameful thing that it was. So this is a brand new population in some respect compared to my parents.
Yeah.
How much of that has become part of the gestalt of what you're working with? As Dr. Schilling just said, this is a major problem, substance abuse and addiction problems in this age group. Where is it coming from?
I would argue that this generation is truly mixed in terms of their willingness to talk about mental health, their insight into the importance of it. I see folks that truly come in, they've been in therapy for years, they're ready and rearing to talk about mental health. And then other people who were raised by that generation where you don't talk about it, you sweep things under the rug, they start talking about all these concerns they have, and they've never really conceptualized it as being a mental health problem. I do believe there's a fair mix in that population.
They're coming from a different set. Social expectations and environmental issues than a generation before. I would imagine that our children would be even a different set in terms of the attitude towards these things. But you referred that they're mixed. I'm just curious as if we can say with any reasonable degree of accuracy, why? Why in this age group are we now seeing so much substance abuse?
If I could filter it down to one broad reason, it's because they have a lot going on and they're reaching for something to medicate internal distress, using something outside of them to treat the internal state. And this population has a lot on their plate.
In reference to Abby's point about this generation perhaps feeling less stigmatized in terms of mental health, in terms of the label of substance use, is that something that you observe, or is there still a lot of concern? You know, we talk a big story. Oh, yeah, we accept all this, but not for me.
In terms of mental health treatment, maybe we're seeing the needle move on that a little bit in terms of stigma. I think with this age group, there is still a great, great stigma about identifying as someone with a substance use disorder. That term is a little bit more easy to stomach for these individuals rather than addict or alcoholic. There's still a major stigma out there.
What about the types of drugs? Dr. Schillinger and I have done a very interesting series on opioid abuse. Are you seeing marijuana use? Are you seeing alcoholism, benzodiazepine use, something else? Can you quantify that if it's at all possible? What's the most common, perhaps?
All of the above. Most common, definitely alcohol. The second place is going to be this mix, either or both opioids and benzodiazepines. And cannabis use is growing at an incredible rate, I think because of the availability of it. Other substances mixed in as well.
for this group, the baby boomer generation. There's the history of free love generation, a lot of drugs back in their earlier years. Does this have implications for their treatment and for the identification of the problem in this particular segment?
Absolutely. We treat so many individuals who grew up in that generation, maybe have always used substances sporadically, recreationally, and not until they have gotten older and their substance use has become more chronic, created more problems in their life, in their relationships, their medical status. It's not really until later life, until they might meet criteria for substance use disorder. We also see a lot of individuals that maybe when they were younger, they recognized they had a problem. They got sober, they were in recovery, maybe up to many decades, and then unfortunately have relapses in older adulthood.
Because I treat addicts, I treat people this age who are not declaring that they have an addiction. But one of the things is the psychosocial components of this age group. If someone's listening to this, they may say, well, you know, I'm not an addict. I don't need to come to you. I think it was in Toronto that they did this years ago, a lot of good studies, that this was a group that was lonelier. They were frightened about not having money. They have a new disease. They're in a marriage that should have ended 10 years ago. How do you get the people to come to you? What do you do with them? I guess basically an overview of your program. What makes you different than so many of the other programs that are out there? And how do you bring people into you?
Our program is specifically designed to treat all of those psychosocial issues that co-occur with substance use disorders. As we get older, grief and loss, maybe the ending of a marriage, independence issues, ambulation issues, loss of purpose, substance use disorders in retirement, once they lose structure and that purpose of their career. A big one also is the cognitive impairment that might be contributing to one's use, such that people lose track of how much they're actually taking or drinking. Those topics are really what this program is designed to treat, being on a unit with peers who understand these issues, who are going through them themselves. Really just being with like-minded, same-aged peers, we have found is incredibly beneficial. How do we get these folks into treatment? Historically, people think when they want to get a friend or a loved one into treatment, you hear the term intervention. That typically does not go over well with older adults. They feel they have been somehow not done right by their family. Lots of negative reactions to interventions. Family might have what we might think of as an intervention, but in a much more gentle and loving, supportive way. It's usually family, many times adult children who are concerned about their parent. A lot of times people are also coming to us from the hospital. Something happens, whether it's a car accident, a fall, some sort of medical emergency, they start experiencing withdrawal symptoms, they have a seizure, something gets them to the hospital where there's identified symptoms of a substance use disorder, and then they're referred to treatment.
Do they accept it? I remember one of my, fortunately, successful patients, I wish I could say they all were successful, who woke up one day and he got his one DUI. He was lucky not to have others. And he said, this isn't working. He decided to make the change. In Alcoholics Anonymous, if no one has ever been to it, on one of the meetings, it's fascinating. People stand up and they take a deep breath and they go, hi, oh, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. When you do an intervention, you're right. I'm very intrigued by that because I see a lot of people, we can't get them into treatment because they don't think they have a problem or they're embarrassed or they can't afford it. Help us. Help the listener. What do you do? What do you do to break through this barrier? Because you've got an active program. You've got a good program. What do you do? Or what do people do?
Like you said, there are these internally motivated patients that recognize something has got to change. I'm sick of feeling this way. I'm tired of the consequences. I'm going to treatment. That's probably more of the minority. Usually folks come to us more externally motivated. Usually some medical scare, a legal consequence, or their family really upholding strong boundaries. Mom, you're not going to be able to see my kids again unless you're sober. I'm done with this marriage unless you stop using. Unfortunately, many folks come to us externally motivated. That's what it often takes to get them in the door. And what's really lovely is by the time they leave, we often start to see this emergence of the internal motivation where they're starting to recognize and gain insight into just all the consequences and the problems.
You referenced when there's external motivation, people coming in, there's actually a reasonable chance of some type of success. But it sounds like perhaps the vast majority of folks walking around with substance use disorder in this age group do not have an external motivation for doing it. So what steps can medical professionals, particularly primary care, do to identify these problems at an earlier stage? Because we always know earlier diagnosis and early treatment tends to have higher success rates.
Yeah, absolutely. As you're meeting with patients, always having in the back of your mind, could what I'm seeing be caused by substances? I can't tell you the number of patients who come in and they've seen every specialist under the sun, and take away the alcohol, the terrible reflux goes away, the hypertension comes down, everything kind of comes back to homeostasis. People will spend a lot of time and energy trying to figure out the source and the cause of all these various problems. Neuropathy is another huge one that we see. It's alcohol related. That was never identified. Just keeping in mind, really screening, what is this patient's substance use, even if it's something that they're not abusing. We treat so many older adults who are taking addictive drugs as prescribed that have become physically dependent, also have complications as a result, or really cannot stop if they try on their own. So keeping that always in the back of your mind, also, if possible, talking to family, getting collateral information. He's telling you he has 2 beers a day. How much is he really drinking?
That brings up an interesting thing, because I think it's critical to keep in mind this is not new onset. And this is usually chronicity that we're now seeing with a different environment. When you're 45, you can bounce against the wall. When you're 65 and 70, it's not so possible. Should there be a formalized screening mechanism? Do you recommend a formalized screening mechanism?
Knowledge is power. The more data we have, we're going to catch some more people. You're going to miss people. How honest are people going to be? I went to grad school for clinical psychology. I did not go to medical school. In dealing with a lot of medical professionals in my job, there's a wide range of levels of education that physicians have with regards to addiction medicine. Having a baseline knowledge, if there is recommended coursework or some sort of certification as a baseline knowledge, I think that could be very beneficial.
Do you think physicians are hesitant to even get into this?
I would say yes.
That's a huge problem. That's a gap.
This population is hard to work with. Is that lack of internal motivation in a lot of patients at the beginning? There's a lot of negative stereotypes about treating substance use disorder. You're treating a quote unquote addict.
And I think another concern amongst physicians, particularly on a primary care level, if you screen and you find a problem, what do you do about treating it? The program you have is excellent, okay, but it's not inexpensive. And for people who don't have the dollars to pay for these things, what can they do? Medicare is not particularly generous in terms of funding for mental health and addiction issues.
You're right. Our program is wonderful. And the reality is that it's expensive. It's not possible for everyone. And I will say residential treatment is also not needed for everyone. There's various levels of care. The American Society of Addiction Medicine publishes their continuum of care that has various levels, everything through early intervention and prevention, all the way up through intensive inpatient. We're kind of one step below that hospitalized level. We're a residential level. There's intensive outpatient, partial hospitalization, outpatient, and many different varieties and types of treatment. When we identify someone with a screener, what do we do? Being able to figure out what level of care is needed, and that ASAM provides those criteria to determine what kind of referrals do I need to give this individual.
There was a proposed bill in Congress, Prevention and Treating Substance Use Disorders Among Older Adults Act, put out last year. From what I understand, it's still kind of like being held. And we hear talk that there's some movement on the federal level to defund and stop SAMHSA.
Yes, I have heard that.
Everybody pretty much is going to the doctor for some type of exam, and it's a perfect time to identify these problems. But doctors will complain they have so much on their plate, so many things they have to screen for, so many things they have to look for. And so often, a substance use disorder, they just write it off as that's just getting older. What can we do? What's a motivating point that we can make to bring more physicians on board to the importance of looking for these things?
I'm usually hearing that from patients or even family members who aren't knowledgeable about substance use disorder. It's just the patient getting older, or they've lived most of their lives. Why would we want to change things for them now? You might as well just keep let them doing what they're doing. Common argument. But just seeing the amount of improvement that these individuals make in a 4 to 6 week period in treatment is totally worth it. They feel better, they sleep better, they can get proper nutrition, their cognition improves, they come in a wheelchair and they walk out on their own 2 feet. There's dozens and dozens of reasons why we should try to still be improving quality of life, even as we get older.
Do you find that there's a difference in the sexes? Men are worse than women, or vice versa? Or let's broaden it a little bit more. Culturally, do you see that in your population? Ethnic backgrounds, vocational backgrounds?
The common thread is all of those psychosocial issues. Unfortunately, addiction does not discriminate. We see it in every gender, religion, socioeconomic status, cultural background. We do have trends demographically in terms of the patients that admit here, but generally speaking, it's throughout various demographic groups.
From that demographic perspective, do you find different levels of acceptance or resistance in terms of recommendation for treatment?
Socioeconomic differences interfere with access to care. I would say, generally speaking, this is anecdotal, men might be harder to crack than women in terms of gaining that insight and developing that internal motivation. I would say those patients that we have here that kind of never come around in terms of that motivation, try to fly under the radar, and really by their discharge just aren't necessarily fully invested in recovery. I would say those are more typically men, but we also see that in some women as well.
We want to look at success. We want to look at outcome. And substance abuse is a condition that can be successfully treated. There's no question about that. And if anybody's listening thinking it can't work for them, then frankly, they're wrong. Sometimes it's difficult, but they're wrong. So how do we get doctors to be selective enough in their screening to become, shall we use the word, gutsy enough to intervene so that people can live the rest of their life without the substance abuse? We're looking, all of us are, continuously for something that works. Relatively easily, if we can make it better and more attractive. You've mentioned a lot of good things. Is there a certain element that seems to be more the core issue as those people who are successful versus those who are less successful? Do you see that trend?
Yes. The individuals who are more successful are those that, as simple as this sounds, follow recommendations.
Okay.
Based on their individualized needs. And it's those individuals that get to a point where they say, tell me what to do. I want to do this. What do I need to do? First year in recovery is the hardest, and giving people an action plan of what to do, who to see, setting up the appointments for them to get them rolling is really, really helpful for success, to really have a plan and be willing to follow that plan. I wanted to speak to something you mentioned previously in your comments about physicians intervening, getting the guts to say something. We have found the most useful intervention, particularly when someone comes in and they don't want to be here, is just education and stating the facts and staying away from terms like addict and alcoholic or addiction, really showing them the diagnostic criteria of substance use disorder. Many people will say, I don't drink in the morning. I don't drink all that much. I know people who drink a lot more than me. I just have a couple drinks. When we point out to them, there's only two of the 11 diagnostic criteria that relate to the amount and the frequency of your use. The other nine are all the consequences that come out of what happens when you drink or you use. Oftentimes, just stating the facts of you meet these 7, 8, 9 criteria, which is diagnostic for a substance use disorder in the severe range, and we know how to treat it, is oftentimes the most helpful thing an older adult can hear.
You bring up a very, very salient characteristic of many people who have substance abuse problems. They are masters at rationalization and masters at denial. Sometimes it's just a habit that they've been in for so many years. So if that can be addressed gently and properly so, that can be an enormously strong entry into what's going on inside of them.
Yeah. In addition to that, I would add, we don't really care why someone develops that motivation to not use or drink. For example, someone might be very much in denial about multiple things related to their substance use disorder, but if they can say, you know what, I'm worried about my memory, and I know this might affect my memory if I keep using, if that's their motivation, fantastic, let's go with it. I don't think I'm an alcoholic, and I don't believe this is really like causing issues in my marriage like my wife says it is, but I hate this neuropathy. If I could get that to feel better, I'll stop. So if you can just hook them on at least one thing, and with sustained sobriety and recovery, all the other positives kind of fall into place along with it.
That's important.
The other side of the coin there is always the ethical question. Are we, as medical professionals, who are we to say, this is what you should be doing, this is what you shouldn't be doing? Going with that rationalization of their behavior, a lot of people don't want to be told otherwise. So are we ethically being fair when we say, this is what you should be doing or not doing?
It's really about education, about the medical side effects, complications, outcomes. I'm not going to tell you whether or not you should or shouldn't do this, but you should know that continued use can make your pain even worse. Letting them know the fact.
So kind of couched in what we would call patient autonomy with informed consent.
Absolutely.
I'll provide as much information as possible and empower the patient to make the decision.
Agreed.
You've taken on a very large, complex population group, but to reiterate, there is a positive end to doing this work. Many people get better. It's worth it. And it's worth a hard try. It truly is. So I applaud you for doing it. And I applaud you for coming here and discussing this difficult area of medicine. Thank you for that.
It is challenging, but it doesn't always go well the first time. And maybe it takes 2, 3, 4 attempts, and then it works.
Dr. Devin Dautrick, PhD, is Supervisor of Psychological Testing Services at the Caring Treatment Centers. Thank you so much for joining us today for this important discussion.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.